Well, again, everybody, welcome to this special edition of the Monterey Podcast. I am Jimmy Davis. This is episode number 47 for Sunday, November 3rd, 2019. And we're going to take a little bit of a detour here in terms of looking at the current news. And we're going to look at a subject that actually does very much relate to the current news. I've kind of teased this a couple of times. Last week I teased it, and actually before we even went on hiatus, I had talked about doing a show on conspiracy theories. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about some of the popular conspiracy theories out there and what's behind them. We're going to talk about the psychology of conspiracy theories. And so, but before I get to that, I would like to talk about a few podcasts that I would highly recommend to you. First of all, my buddy Fritz over at the Fritzcast. If you just want to search Fritzcast on Apple Podcasts or any of the platforms that you listen to podcasts, I think you would enjoy him very much. He's a libertarian, but he's a fair libertarian, and he's gotten to do some interviews with Bernie Sanders. So if that intrigues you, you want to listen to that show. So it's Fritzcast. You'll find him on Twitter at Fritzcastqs and on Facebook.com/TheFritzcast. Or I don't know if it's The Fritzcast or Fritzcast, but you'll find it. You'll find it. Another thing that I've talked about before is I'm into old-time wrestling, or at least listening to podcasts about old-time wrestling. So I've got a couple of podcasts that I would highly recommend to you. It's The Jim Cornette Experience and Jim Cornette's Drive-Thru. So Jim Cornette Experience comes out every Thursday. Just very entertaining. Lots of foul language. So just a warning for that. Lots of foul language in that. But a very, very entertaining podcast. It does make my drive to work every day a little more enjoyable when I have that. The next four podcasts, I have four more that I want to talk about. And these are all from Wondery. Wondery has some great content. They do a good job with it. They have a daily podcast called The Lead. It's from The Athletic, so it's done in partnership with The Athletic, and it's basically sports stories. So they'll, you know, dive into a current sports story or something, you know, around the league. Kind of gets behind the scenes. Some really good stuff there. It's only about 20 minutes, 20 to 25 minutes a day. So most people could probably get that in on a daily basis. There's another podcast. Season 2 is coming out shortly. It's called The City. Season 1 of The City was about a town in the west side of Chicago that was being used as a dumping ground for construction material. And the politics behind that and how that all occurred and how things were said were going to, you know, turn around there, and they didn't. It was a six or eight part series. I can't remember off the top of my head. Those came out about a year and a half ago. And so season 2 of The City is going to be looking at the city of Reno and how strip clubs are trying to be pushed out and how the strip club owners are fighting back. So there is a preview episode available for season 2 of The City. I believe that by the time you hear this, actually, the season 2 may already drop at least the first episode of it, because it was supposed to drop in late October. So look for that on Apple Podcasts as well. Two more that they have, Bad Batch. It's about a controversy surrounding stem cells and stem cell treatments. And so I just started listening to that one. I've gotten through the first episode, and it hooked me in completely. So I will be listening to the rest of that, and I hope you will as well. They've only released the first two episodes, and it's something that drops weekly. So that is a brand new podcast. And finally, something that is surrounding a current event, and that's the mysterious Mr. Epstein. So we've all heard about Jeffrey Epstein and some of the mysteries surrounding his death, and it has actually led to, believe it or not, conspiracy theories. Either Trump had him killed or that the Clintons had him killed, depending on who you ask. So there's a lot of conspiracy theories around him. So they will dispel some of that and get to who he is and take a deep dive into what he is like. So I haven't started listening to that one, but the trailer really had me intrigued. So I'm going to listen to that one as well. So I'd recommend from Wondery, The Lead, The City, Bad Batch, and The Mysterious Mr. Epstein. Okay, now to the topic du jour. Conspiracy theories. I think it's a very timely subject, and I thought it was back when I was talking about it 4.5 months ago. And I think it's even more relevant today, because there are conspiracy theories surrounding what happened in the Ukraine and what is behind the motivation of Donald Trump and his phone call with the Ukrainian president. Now, there are, as we talked about on last week's show, there are really two broad camps that you fall into. You either believe that there's nothing to be found here and that the only reason that Donald Trump is doing this is to take out a political opponent, because he knows that Joe Biden is probably the only person that can really have a good chance of beating him. He probably has got a good chance of beating anybody else, including Elizabeth Warren. So if you get rid of him during the primaries, then you don't have to worry about it. And if you can damage him in the primaries, then you're in good shape. And the only reason that I think that has some merit to it is because, for one thing, there is, they talk about no evidence of Joe Biden helping out his son. And when you look at that, there's actually evidence to show that he wasn't, because if you look at the timeline and when he went to Ukraine and was threatening to withhold loan guarantees, that really showed, I think, what the timing of that shows what the motivation was. And he was there on direct orders of President Obama at the time. But if you're on the other side of it and you really believe, And here's the thing, is that as we get into the psychology of it, you begin to question whether or not Trump is doing this from a nefarious standpoint, or if he truly is buying 100% into conspiracy theories. And if the people around him are pitching conspiracy theories to him, and he's running with them because he truly believes them. Because as we talk about these different theories, you're going to hear some that you're like, oh my God, that's crazy. And you're going to hear some that you may believe in, that you actually really truly believe are the truth. The conspiracy theory is the truth. So that got me to thinking, what is the psychology behind conspiracy theories and why do people believe in them? Well, there's three. When they did some research, and this is the University of Kent researchers, Karen Douglas, Robbie Sutton, and Alexandra Kachoka. I'm horrible at pronouncing names. Kachachka. I'm not going to talk about the names anymore. So those three people. They report on these findings in the Current Directions in Psychological Science. They identify three psychological motives that drive conspiracy theories. These are epistemic, which is a way to make sense of chaos and random events; existential, this pursuit of safety, security, and empowerment; and finally, social, a desire for belonging to a group with a shared belief system. Researchers have found a prevalence of superstition and conspiracy theories among people who seek meaning and patterns in the environment and who possess a low tolerance for uncertainty. Conspiracy belief is also indicative of a concept known as collective narcissism, a belief that one's own social group is superior but unappreciated by other people. Does that sound familiar? If you believe in vaccines and you get into a debate with an anti-vaxxer, they show a lot of these characteristics. They believe that they know better than everybody else, and that they are upset that they're not being recognized for figuring it out. Like, why can't these people get on board with us? We figured it out. They haven't. They're in the dark on this thing. They're just buying the medical companies, bullshit. Moreover, groups who feel they have been victimized are more likely to endorse conspiracy theories. So maybe somebody that does vaccinate their child and ends up with a child with autism. Now, is that cause and effect, or is that just a coincidence? And the numbers would show there's a low enough occurrence rate that it probably really is not the vaccination piece of it is not tied to autism. Like, had the child not been exposed to the vaccine, that would they have gotten autism anyway? Who knows? The other thing and kind of on a side note, the other thing that bothers me about autism is it's a relatively subjective diagnosis. There are certain behaviors that are associated with it and that you could probably make a good case that it is. But there are some that are the borderline that they say highly functioning autism. When you say the term high functioning autism, I believe that there may be some ambiguity there in terms of the actual diagnosis. And they talk about how the diagnoses of autism have gone way up. Well, is it because that we were mischaracterizing things from before? Like, you know, back in the 80s, the big diagnosis back then to explain behavior problems was ADD. But I think if you were to take those children and put them in today's terms, they would be diagnosed with autism. And so I think that's why you've seen an increase in the diagnosis of autism, not because it's occurring more frequently, but because, number one, maybe we're identifying it more accurately, or we're over-identifying it. And maybe this is a conspiracy theory that I'm pitching out there on my own. Who knows? But I think that it's subjective enough. Like, I've known some parents that have said, oh yeah, my kid's slightly autistic. And you look at how the parents actually treat the kids and they don't pay attention to the kid. And you start to realize, no, your kid is not autistic. They're just seeking attention because you're not giving it to them. You're ignoring them. And so they act out. Because when you're with the kid, like, let's say the kid comes over to your house and you're paying attention, you're engaging with them, the kid's completely normal. The kid doesn't show any signs of autism. And so sometimes parents will use the autism argument as a crutch to explain bad behavior when they don't want to blame themselves. And I think that goes back to collective narcissism. It's like, well, it can't be my fault. It can't. I'm a perfect parent. Couldn't be my fault at all. It sounds like a certain president we know of, right? Anyway, so more on the psychology of conspiracy theories. So when we talk about those three categories, epistemic, existential and social. The epistemic drawbacks of conspiracy theories do not seem to be readily apparent to people who lack the ability or motivation to think critically or rationally. Conspiracy belief is correlated with lower levels of analytic thinking and lower levels of education. It is also associated with the tendency, to overestimate the likelihood of co-occurring events and the tendency to perceive agency and intentionality where it does not exist. So that's where I think a lot of the flat earthers come into being. There's all this evidence. There's all this evidence of the earth being round, and yet they refuse to believe it. And I've never understood that. We'll get into that later, though. Looking at existential motivations, experiments have shown that compared with baseline conditions, conspiracy belief is heightened when people feel unable to control outcomes and is reduced when their sense of control is affirmed. So that's, again, about the security and having understanding of these seemingly random events. So again, when you start to talk about some of these conspiracy theories that I'm going to point out, we're not going to get into a lot of detail on most of these. We're going to get into the detail of a few political ones. But as you think about them and you've seen these, and whether you believe them or not, keep these kind of patterns and behaviors in mind. Finally, under social motives, casual explanations, conspiracy explanations included, are also informed by various social motivations, including the desire to belong and to maintain a positive image of the self and the in-group. Members of groups who have objectively low status because of their ethnicity or income are more likely to endorse conspiracy theories. Conspiracy belief also has been linked to prejudice against powerful groups and those perceived as enemies. So when you talk about the Rothschild in the Illuminati type of conspiracy theories, and the Clintons for that matter, right? Conspiracy belief is associated with narcissism, an inflated view of oneself that requires external validation and is linked to paranoid ideation. So that, I think, is why when you look at Donald Trump, part of me really believes that he truly believes what he's saying. He thinks that he made a good call. He thinks that what he's doing is the right thing because he's trying to root out corruption, because he is convinced that what he sees with Joe Biden, what they did, was wrong. Now, part of the sub-psychology to that, you know, maybe it's even under the surface, you know, in the subconscious of Donald Trump, is that he's jealous that Hunter Biden made all this money, and that Joe Biden, he believes, was able to use his power to do that, and when he tries to do it, it gets shot down, and he's jealous of it. That's a conspiracy theory on my part, but I think that part of that is because he's so driven by money and fortune and social status that if he sees others that are perceived enemies of his being successful, there's got to be something nefarious going on. And so therefore, that's why he's trying to root out. Groups that feel they've been victimized are more likely to endorse conspiracy theories about powerful outgroups. Again, Illuminati, Clintons, things like that. But there is something else to be said. There is something to be said about conspiracy theories, and we'll get to that in just a moment. Experiments show that exposure to conspiracy theories decrease trust in government institutions, even if the conspiracy theories are unrelated to those institutions. It also causes disenchantment with politicians and scientists. So when you talk about scientists, that's when you get to climate change and the belief in those. And if there's any one conspiracy theory that I may give some substance to, is climate change. So when we talk about those, I'll kind of expand on that a little bit. Research thus far has successfully articulated some of the motivations that, together with deficiencies in available information, cognitive ability, and motivation to think critically, may contribute to conspiracy belief. But there's got to be a lot more done in this area. However, on the flip side of all of this, it just sounds like, you know, conspiracy theorists are just trying to validate themselves, they're not educated, and they shouldn't be taken seriously. However, this same piece also says the following. Conspiracy belief may offer an important source of belonging and shared reality. Furthermore, history has repeatedly shown that corporate and political elites do conspire against public interests. Conspiracy theories play an important role in bringing their misdeeds into the light. So in other words, there may be some things that were thought of to be conspiracy theories before that actually proved to be quite true. And, you know, there's, and so it's not that we should completely discount conspiracy theories, but we should question, you know, what the point is, we should question authority. We shouldn't just believe that automatically go to default to they're doing something evil. But it does beg us to trust but verify, right? And I think that was the Reagan mantra. So trust but verify, I think, is the key to making sure that we can use conspiracy theories effectively. So let's look at some conspiracy theories that are out there. And so I just pulled up Wikipedia and list of conspiracy theories. There are some, you know, we've heard of chemtrails. That's an example of a conspiracy theory, and that somehow those contrails we see, which is just, you know, it's science, right? It's water vapor, but somehow the belief is airplanes are dropping chemicals behind them to make us sick for some reason. I still haven't figured out what the motivation of that is. There's a bunch related to deaths and disappearances. We just talked about one with Jeffrey Epstein. And there's also very popular ones. The assassination of JFK. The death of Elvis. People think he's still alive. The death of Tupac. They think he's still alive. There's a certain number of people that actually believe that Elvis is still alive. And I just saw one this morning, actually. It was a while ago, I should say. It was last week where I saw my buddy Fritz. He is not entirely convinced that Osama bin Laden was killed. And so there are conspiracy theories behind that. You know, when you look at economics and society, you've heard of the New World Order, and there's like a group of elites that are basically controlling everything, and that, you know, we need to be mindful of all of those people. The Denver airport. There is a belief that the headquarters for the Denver airport or the headquarters for the New World Order is buried underneath the Denver airport. And the reason for that is because of its size. It's land size. It's about 50 square miles. Why do you need such a big area for an airport? Well, for one thing, it's so you can control development around it. And FAA regulations require that. And it allows for plenty of expansion of the airport. But, you know, planning things out, you know, Denver still has a lot of room to grow. They're doing a lot of development there. Still a lot of people are moving there. So they need a bigger airport. They're going to need a bigger airport as time goes on. But the fact that it was built so far away from the city, at least the city at the time when it was built, and its size, and there's also satanic paintings within the airport, and therefore that's part of the theory.
You cannot be serious!
Then you've got George Soros, of course, is another one that a lot of people believe and I think that goes to be honest with you, I believe that's an anti-Semitic one. That goes back to the old belief that Jews control the money and they control the power, and they are the power brokers behind the scenes and manipulating everything behind the scenes, and there's Zionism, and you know, the Zionists are taking over and blah, blah, blah. So that's where I believe a lot of the George Soros narrative comes from, which is funny because, you know, we talk about, you know, people like that and people that are powerful and rich and have given to political causes. What about the Koch brothers? Are those, I mean, is that, there's no conspiracy theory there? I would argue that, you know, people are, you know, if people are wealthy and that's what they want to do with their money, that's what they want to do with their money. And they want to give it to political causes. He gives them to a lot of charities too. A lot of what he does is related to charities. And not necessarily just political beliefs. But the Koch brothers were doing the same thing. So, I don't know. Seems kind of odd that we're going to point that one out, but not Koch brothers as being a conspiracy theory. 9-11. The fact that it was an inside job. That's a conspiracy theory that's been out there for a long time. And again, I think it's because it's a traumatic event. And it feels like it explains a lot of the unknowns that are going into that. People don't want to believe that our government is simply doesn't understand some things or could let something like that happen. But if you think about it, they can only stop so much. And that's where I always think it's like, well, you know, you think the government's spying on you, right? That's another thing. We talk about the deep state and, you know, espionage and things like that and spying on the public. And so if you believe in that, then that's probably why you'd also believe that 9/11 was an inside job. Or the two may be mutually exclusive. But I guess my point is, is that if they can pull this off as an inside job, then absolutely they have enough time to spy on their people. But if you don't believe that 9/11 it was a inside job, then how could they then be sophisticated enough to actually spy on all 330 million of us? Are there things that are picking up my voice right now? Yes, I have an Amazon Dot in my room that is probably listening to everything I'm saying. But does it really matter? Because I'm putting this out there to the public anyway, right? It doesn't really matter that it's out there. that they're listening to it. My whole thing was, is first of all, the government doesn't have the resources or the time to care about what every single person in this country is doing. But if you're doing something bad, I think I'd like them to know about it. You know, that's just the bottom line to me. I just don't understand why people think that, you know, the government has time, or even the local police force has time, to spy and think about what you're doing. They don't. They don't. Because if they did that, then the real bad guys would get away with stuff, because there's no way they could keep up with it. I know the staffing of, at least at the local level, and there's absolutely zero possibility that they're spying on you unless they have an absolute reason to do so. They just don't have the time to waste on people that are just normal people doing normal stuff. They don't care. You know, don't be so narcissistic to think that the government cares about what you're doing. They don't. You're not important to them. You're not important to them in terms of what you're doing. They don't have time to worry about it. And if they were, bad things would happen in this country, because there's just not enough resources to watch everything. So you got to focus your attention on the areas that actually do have real activity that shouldn't be happening to keep us safe. So don't flatter yourself to believe that the government is spying on you and watching you, because they don't have time, and frankly, it's not important to them. Sandy Hook is another one. As a matter of fact, the Sandy Hook, the conspiracy theorists actually were ordered to pay $450,000 by a jury. So listen to this story. Wisconsin jury Tuesday, and this was a couple of weeks ago, a Wisconsin jury ordered a conspiracy theorist who claimed the grieving father of a victim of the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre had fabricated his son's death certificate to pay the father $450,000. A judge had ruled in June that James Fetzer, co-author of the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, had defamed Leonard Posner, father of Noah, 6 years old, the youngest victim of the 2012 mass shooting, by falsely claiming that Posner had fabricated copies of his son's death certificate. The claim was made by the retired professor in his book, which argued that Newtown, Connecticut mass shooting, which left 20 first graders and 6 staff members dead, never happened and was instead a hoax staged by the federal government in an effort to pass stricter gun laws. So this is where conspiracy theories can really start to affect people personally. To accuse somebody that had lost their son of faking his death is just, it's sickening. It is absolutely sickening that people believe that this really didn't happen. There are real people that were affected by this. If my kid were killed in something like this, and then someone accused me of faking his death, I would be, the money wouldn't matter to me. I'd probably be in jail for murder, because I'd kill him. How dare you say that kind of thing to me? So when you're starting to think about and throwing out these conspiracy theories, in this particular case, it really affects real people. And it's sickening to see that kind of thing happen. So that's another conspiracy theory out there. There's, of course, tons of conspiracy theories surrounding the Clintons. And we're going to talk about a couple. We're going to talk about the email controversy. We're going to talk about Benghazi. We're going to talk a little bit about Uranium One. And another one that's kind of related to that is the deep state. So there's a theory about the conspiracy theory about the deep state. And now this term is not a new term, all right? And the term is occasionally used as a neutral term to denote a national bureaucracy. The conspiratorial notion is of a deep state is a concept of originating principally in Middle Eastern and North African politics, with some basis in truth, and has been known in the U.S. since the 1960s. But the basis behind the deep state is that you have these bureaucrats that are actually the real power brokers behind the scenes. Now, the reality is that government cannot be completely wholesale replaced. You're not going to be able to take 1.5 million people. Now, you could argue that government's too big in general, and that's fine. The vast majority of people in government are just going there, doing their jobs, and going home. They're not worried about the politics. They're not up to that level, okay? But you can't wholesale change all those people out when a new administration comes in. So yes, there are going to be people that are going to be career bureaucrats that are going to be there no matter whether there's a Republican or a Democrat in the White House. It's not going to matter. You have to have that in order to function. Now, again, if you want to argue that government's too big, okay, that's a completely different argument. And that is not related to the deep state conspiracy theory. That is just a philosophical argument. That is a political argument that people are more than free to have. But the deep state conspiracy theory is very, very interesting, that somehow the bureaucrats behind the scenes are fighting one way or another for something. But you have people that in their personal lives are Republicans, and there's Democrats in Washington, in the federal government in general. However, a 2017 poll by ABC News and the Washington Post indicated that 48% of Americans believe in the existence of a conspiratorial deep state in the U.S. Now, these really have come to being by promoted by areas like Breitbart News, InfoWars, and Donald Trump himself. I know that Sean Hannity's big on the deep state, and that's why that would explain everything that's bad that's happening to Donald Trump. Not that he actually did anything wrong, right? They don't believe that. They believe that's a conspiracy theory, but they truly believe that there is this deep state working against him. And maybe there are people in the government that are working against him because they know, and actually there has been. There was an anonymous source that came out and said, yes, we were working against the president. But because he's batshit crazy. That's why they're going after him. It has nothing to do with, you know, the deep state. It's because he's got stuff that if they let him just do what, you know, just do whatever he wanted to do, who knows what we would be. I mean, you see his tweets. His tweets can make the stock market go up and down. So just imagine what he can do with foreign policy if he was given completely free rein. And anybody that goes in the White House, no matter who they are, needs to know that they're not going to be able to just do everything on their own. They've got to take the advice of people that are experienced. And I think that's when you see a lot of promises being made on the campaign trail that they're not kept, is because they simply get into the office and they find out, oh crap, I can't actually do that. And it's not because the deep state doesn't allow them to do it. It's because the law doesn't allow them to do it. The president is not as powerful as people think. Now, over time, Congress has ceded power to the presidency, and that has caused a lot of issues. But for the most part, those stories, those policies can't be implemented because the power has a lot of it has to be done in conjunction with the legislature, and a lot of people don't realize that. Not even people running for president. And I think if you ask any ex-president, they're gonna like, yeah, I actually didn't have as much power as I thought it was going to. But that was the intention. That was the way that the founding fathers intended this country to be. Checks and balances. Because if you didn't have that, and you had a much more powerful executive branch, then this country would look very different than it does today. So anyway, that is another theory out there. Then Trump and Ukraine. Now look, now here's a couple of, before we get to the political ones, I kind of got into those a little bit sooner than I'd like, because I'm just kind of reading this list in order. Vaccinations is another one I talked about briefly earlier. I'm the anti-vaxxers. I don't understand what their motivation is. You know, before vaccines, we would have polio, measles. They would be diseases that were debilitating and led to death. Now, we've eradicated a lot of these, except for this movement that now we're trying to get rid of vaccines, or at least have enough people that are not vaccinated that these diseases are making a comeback, when all you have to do is get a shot that for the, you know, 99% of people doesn't harm them. And there's a small percentage that can't get them. And so I don't do it just to protect myself and my kids. I do it to protect other people's kids who don't, because I know I have friends that have children that cannot get vaccinated because their immune system is compromised or because they have other physical conditions that prevent them from getting vaccines. And so if I don't get my kid vaccinated and my kid gets sick and transmits it to my friend's kid, my friend's kid can't fight it. My friend's kids may not get better. They may not recover and they may die as a result of that. So is it fair because you have this certain belief that now, because there's enough people out there, that they now have to question whether or not they should take their kid to places like Disneyland because they're afraid that there's enough people that don't have vaccines out there that might expose them to an illness that can kill their kid? I mean, you know, I guess there are selfish people like that. But if you're not going to vaccinate your kid, don't take them to public places. So when schools say, hey, if you want to come to the school, you need to have the kid vaccinated. And you say, no, it's my personal belief. I don't want to do that. Okay, well, then that's your choice. And it's also your choice then to keep to homeschool your kid. Because if your kid gets sick and exposes kids that can't get a vaccine, even though they would like to otherwise, then whose fault is that? I believe that if somebody chooses not to get their kid vaccinated, their kid gets sick, and then they get another kid sick that is that can't get vaccinated, I believe that that person should be held personally responsible. They should be held personally and financially responsible for the treatment of that child. So that's my thought on vaccines. Targeted individuals is another one. And I kind of talked about that a little bit. Again, the government doesn't have time to worry about you. And I know there's people that are paranoid that they think the government's spying on them and looking after them. Like, dude, we don't have time to care about what you're doing. We don't think you're doing anything wrong. So why do you think we're watching you? We don't care. Sorry, I don't have time for that. You know, in a city with 150,000, 160,000 people, I don't have time to worry about one that I don't really have any concerns over, other than the fact that they're crazy, and they think they're paranoid that I'm watching them. It's like, no, I don't have time to watch you. I've got way too much other crap to do than to be sitting here watching you all the time. So that's another one that there's people out there, and I think that's a more of a mental deficiency thing. It's a paranoia, and there's psychological issues there that go beyond just the normal conspiracy theory. And the last one, of course, and my personal favorite, is the flat Earth conspiracy theory. I've still yet to figure out why this is even a thing. The Earth was proved to be round hundreds of years ago. And now we have plenty of evidence, plenty of footage, whether it's on the moon or in the space station or even flying in an airplane, that show that the Earth is round. And yet they still debunk, they still argue against all those things. It's like, yes, here's a picture of the Earth being round. No, that's doctored. Huh? Why? Why would they do that? What is the motivation to spend billions of dollars? Because the same people that believe the Earth is flat also don't believe in the moon landing. Most of, I think there's more people that believe that the moon landing was staged than in flat Earth. But I'm pretty almost certain that all flat earthers believe that the moon landing was staged. Because in their mind, if that was the case, it had to be, right? So, because that would actually prove that the Earth is round, if you look at it. But I just don't understand why the government would spend so much money and so much effort to doctor all these things and do all this research and things like that. And they're not even doing research on it. They're just showing what it is, that somehow that they're covering up for the fact that the Earth is flat. Okay, if it is flat, who the hell cares? Why is that such a big deal? You know? And then I remember there was an eclipse of a couple years back that flat earthers said, yes, this proves that the Earth is round because the Earth supposedly rotates one way and then the eclipse is going the other way. It's like, dude, don't you understand basic geometry? This is where geometry. See, when people are like, oh, we don't need this in real life. Actually, you do, because if you understood basic geometry, you would understand why that's the case. The Earth that rotates at a certain speed and you have its diameter, right, or its circumference. Then you take the circumference of the moon's you know, the moon's orbit, right, around the Earth. It's going to be way bigger because the radius between the two is 200,000 miles. So the circumference of the moon's rotation or revolution around the Earth is much bigger. Because they're like, well, it only takes the Earth one day to go around, but 28 days for the moon. And therefore, why is it moving? Why is the moon, you know, there's no way the moon can move faster. Actually, would have to. It would have to. Because otherwise, it would be behind the Earth. If it can get, you know, it's the circumference of the moon's orbit or the distance of the moon's orbit around the Earth is more than 28 times that of the Earth's circumference. And therefore, if the moon needs to get around the Earth in 28 days, it has to go faster than the Earth's rotation. So hopefully that explanation made sense, but it just comes down to basic geometry if you don't, you know, look it up if you don't believe me. Okay, so let's talk about a couple of things that I know are out there. For one thing that we hear about with Hillary Clinton and her deleted emails, right? Where are the emails? Where are those 30,000 emails? Well, I'm going to tell you that right now. And there's a conspiracy theory as to why they deleted them, because there was something hidden there, right? Well, she handed over another 30,000. So about half were personal and half were government related, right? And I think that this is all an old school mentality. You know, I just want to use one device, one email address. I don't want to get it on, you know, because I know people that have used their work email address for personal stuff. And it seems to be an older generation that tends to do that, because it's pretty easy to have two different email accounts or two different email addresses on one mobile device or even one computer. So I think it's a generational thing more than anything. In 2014, months prior to public knowledge of the server's existence, the email server's existence, Clinton chief of staff Cheryl Mills and two attorneys worked to identify work-related emails on the server to be archived and preserved for the State Department. Upon completion of this task in December 2014, Mills instructed Clinton's computer service provider Platte River Networks to change the server's retention period to 60 days. Allowing 31,830 older personal emails to be automatically deleted from the server, as Clinton had decided she no longer needed them. However, Platte River Networks, the Platte River Networks technician assigned for this task, failed to carry it out at the time. After the existence of the servers became publicly known on March 2, 2015, the Select Committee on Benghazi issued a subpoena for Benghazi-related emails 2 days later. Mills sent an email to PRN, which is Platte River Networks, on March 9th, mentioning the committee's retention request. The PRN technician then had what described to the FBI as a, quote, oh shit moment, realizing he had not set the personal emails to be deleted as instructed months earlier. So in order to CYA, the technician then erased the emails using a free utility bleach blitz. It's not physical bleach. He didn't take like some kind of chemical and pour it on the freaking hard drive. Bleach bit is basically something just to erase it. Because let me explain a little computer science to y'all. When you delete a file on your computer, you notice how quickly the your recycle bin empties. If you delete a file, it goes to the recycle bin. And then when you empty the recycle bin, it empties pretty quickly, right? The reason it does so quickly is because it's not actually physically deleting the actual file. What it's doing is it's deleting the reference to that file. Okay. So, and then basically it tells the hard drive, okay, now wherever that was stored is now free to be written over, which is how you get space back on your hard drive. But the data doesn't go physically away. And somebody that knows what they're doing, can do forensics on computers, can go back and reconstruct those files, even if they're completely deleted. There is the ability to do that, but you need special software to do it. So what BleachBit does is it basically goes in and says, okay, finds those files that were supposed to have been deleted that aren't allocated to a certain, you know, don't have a location anymore to be located, and then takes that and wipes that data out and basically turns into a bunch of zeros so that it truly is just no data there. You know, it's and it's now free to be written on. So that's what BleachBit does, and it's a free utility. It's not some expensive piece of software to that spies use to get rid of their crap. You know, it's a free utility. Anybody can get it. And he did this sometime between March 25th and March 31st. Since this episode, Clinton critics have accused her or her aides of deleting emails that were under subpoena, alleging the server had been bleached or acid washed by a very expensive process. In an effort to destroy evidence, with candidate Donald Trump stating the day before the 2016 election that Hillary Clinton erased more than 30,000 emails as part of a cover-up, Trump continued this with this narrative as late as August 2018, and actually even to this day he still says it, asking, look at the crimes that Clinton did with this with the emails, and she deletes 33,000 after she gets a subpoena from Congress, and this Justice Department does nothing about it? Well, now, more recently, there was an article that came out. Let me see if I can find it here. Let's see. Give me a second here. 38. Okay, so here's the headline. 38 people cited for violations in Clinton email probe. And this was posted about a couple of weeks ago. The State Department has completed its internal investigation into former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's use of private email and found 30 violations by 38 people, some of whom may face disciplinary action. Although the report identifies violations, it says investigators had found no persuasive evidence of systemic, deliberate mishandling of classified information. So, again, this is these are related to the emails that they actually turned over, okay, and having them on that private server. What kind of information was in danger of being hacked into. However, it was also made clear that Clinton's use of the private email had increased the vulnerability of classified information, and that was the fear. The report concluded that the use of a private email system to conduct official business had an increased degree of risk of compromise, as a private system lacks the network monitoring and intrusion detection of capabilities of State Department networks. And which is absolutely true, by the way. You know, they have security experts. They have very sophisticated monitoring systems that look at all the traffic going in and out to ensure that things that are that's only stuff that's supposed to be going in and out, and nothing else. And private networks just don't have the manpower or the capabilities or the expertise to adequately do the job that the State Department would do. So that was the concern. But the investigation covered 33,000 emails that Clinton turned over for review after her use of a private email account became public. The department said it found a total of 588 violations involving information then or now deemed to be classified, but could not assign fault in 497 cases. So that's where, you know, Sean Hannity posted, like, look, 600 violations by the Clintons, and so therefore, by Hillary Clinton, therefore, something really bad happened. Excuse me. So there's that. Benghazi. Let's take a look at Benghazi. That's another good one. Or yeah, before we go to Benghazi, let's go to Uranium One. Let's go to the timeline on that. So the allegation is that basically Hillary Clinton sold uranium to the Russians. That's the conspiracy theory. Regards to Uranium One, and there was kickbacks as a result, also for a yes vote, and there was kickbacks for that yes vote. Frank Gustra donates $31.3 million to the Clinton Foundation to be followed by in 2007 with a pledge for at least $100 million. So 2005, he donates $31.3 million. In 2007, he donates pledges to donate $100 million more. On April 20th, 2007, Uranium One is acquired by Eurasia Energy, a Canadian firm with headquarters in Vancouver, from Frank Gustra, who then resigned from the Eurasia Energy Board of Directors. Having severed ties with Eurasia Energy and Uranium One in 2007, Gustra had no evident beneficial interest in the firm's subsequent sale to Rosatom in 2010. And so the whole idea that somehow these donations were tied to some kind of kickback for a favor to this guy is ridiculous because the money was given way before he, before this even became a thing. And by the time it actually became a thing, he was no longer involved with it. The guy that actually donated the money was no longer even involved. So he made the sale was completed 2 months before he made his pledges to the Clinton Foundation. So the acquisition of Uranium One by Rosatom was reviewed by the Committee of Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS, a committee of 9 government cabinet departments and agencies, including the United States Department of State, which was then headed by Hillary Clinton. Clinton herself did not sit on CFIUS, but rather the State Department was represented by Jose Fernandez, the Assistant Secretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Business Affairs, who stated that Clinton was not involved in the Uranium One matter. CFIUS unanimously approved the Uranium One sale. The Utah Division of Radiation Control and Canada's Foreign Investment Review Agency also approved the transaction. So there's the Uranium One controversy kind of in a nutshell. Now, Benghazi. So there's a lot to go over with Benghazi, and I don't think we need to cover it all. But basically, if you look at what happened, it was an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Libya. And the accusation is that they, number one, knew about it and had video footage of what was going on and chose to do nothing about it, which was found to be false. The thing that they did wrong here was they blamed a video of this rather than this being a coordinated attack. And they refused to call it a terrorism attack. When in fact, you look at the Al-Qaeda involvement in this, and yeah, maybe the timing was suspect because of the video that was posted that's showing bad things about Islam, and there was protests in Cairo that were related. But let's look at this. Secretary of State Clinton said, "Some have sought to justify this vicious behavior along with the protests that took place at our embassy in Cairo yesterday as a response to inflammatory material posted on the internet. But whether true or not, that was not a justification for violence." On September 16th, the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, appeared on 5 major news network shows to discuss the attacks. Prior to her appearance, Rice was provided with talking points from a CIA memo, which stated, "The currently available information suggests that the demonstrations in Benghazi were spontaneously inspired by the protest at the U.S. Embassy in Cairo and evolved into a direct assault against the U.S. diplomatic post in Benghazi and subsequently its annex. There are indications that extremists participated in the violent demonstrations. The assessment may change as additional information is collected and analyzed, and as currently available information continues to be evaluated. The investigation is ongoing, and the U.S. government is working with Libyan authorities to bring to justice those responsible for the death of U.S. citizens." Since Rice's 5 television appearances, there have been persistent accusations that she had intentionally and repeatedly lied. However, none of the 10 Benghazi investigations determined she had. For example, the Republican-controlled House Intelligence Committee did not conclude that Rice or any other government official acted in bad faith or intentionally misled the American people. In a White House press briefing on September 18th, Press Secretary Jay Carney explained the attacks to reporters. "I'm saying that based on information that we have, our initial information, and that includes all information, we saw no evidence to back up claims by others that this was a pre-planned or premeditated attack, that we saw evidence that it was sparked by reactions to this video. And that is what we know thus far based on the evidence, concrete evidence." So again, this is just in the days after the attack. And I think as the investigation went on, they realized that, crap, we probably said that when we shouldn't have. Spokesman for the Director of National Intelligence on September 28th said, "In the immediate aftermath, there was information that led us to assess that the attack began spontaneously following protests earlier that day at our embassy in Cairo. We provided that initial assessment to executive branch officials and members of Congress. As we learned more about the attack, we revised our initial assessment to reflect new information indicating that it was a deliberate and organized terrorist attack carried out by extremists. It remains unclear if any group or person exercised overall command and control of the attack, and if extremist groups directed their members to participate. Now, again, when you look at Clinton's testimony in front of the Senate on January 23rd, 2013, during testimony at a Senate hearing on Benghazi, Clinton engaged in a heated exchange with Ron Johnson when Johnson pressed her to explain why, in the immediate aftermath, no one from the State Department had asked American evacuees if there had been a protest before the attack. Clinton replied, "With all due respect, the fact is we had 4 dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night and decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make?" And that piece was picked up by conservative media. That one piece of the sentence, "What difference does it make?" And that was to say that Clinton didn't care about the people that were killed. That in response to questions about the 4 people that were killed, what difference does it make? But if you think about it in the whole context, I've started reading it so far and I'll continue. "It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again. Senator, honestly, I will do my best to answer your questions about this, but the fact that is that people were trying to, in real time, to get the best information. The intelligence community has a process, I understand, going with other committees to explain how these talking points came about. But you know, to be clear, it is, from my perspective, less important today, looking backwards, as to why these militants decided they did it, than to find them and bring them to justice. And then maybe we'll figure out what was going on in the meantime." On May 13th, 2013, President Obama stated in a news conference, "The day after it happened, I acknowledged that this was an act of terrorism. This claim was disputed by Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post in a fact checker article, which explored at length the difference in meaning between the phrases act of terror and act of terrorism. In the article, Kessler accused Obama of revisionist history for stating he had called the attack an act of terrorism, when in fact he had used the term act of terror, observing that Obama had gone out of his way to avoid calling the incident an act of terrorism or blame the ambassador's death on terrorism." So again, this is not about cover-ups. I think it's about just being hasty and being sloppy in how you disseminate information. But the problem, one of the issues we have today is because you have to be so quick with information, sometimes it's not accurate. And that's a big problem these days. And so the things that Clinton is attacked on, whether it's Benghazi, whether it's emails, I think that you take some information and it's being twisted around into some conspiracy theory. And why is she being protected? She's not being protected in these situations. You look at the evidence and she's not being protected. But people don't want to look at the evidence. They just want to believe what they believe because they don't agree with their politics. And it's okay to not agree with somebody's politics. But to accuse them of things that they just simply didn't do is dangerous. And that's what a lot of times conspiracy theories can do. Just like we saw in Sandy Hook. You're really affecting real people. Now, in this case, when you're going after politicians, everything's fair game. But to believe that some of these things happened when in fact they didn't is truly, truly, truly dangerous. So again, I hope this kind of cleared some things up. You have, of course, the controversy. Now you fast forward to today and you look at the whole thing with Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and how we got to where we are with that whole thing. And the bottom line is with the whole Ukrainian phone call is, I believe you have a president right now that truly is a conspiracy theorist. I believe that he believes what he's doing. He's not trying to hide anything. I believe that he's just that mentally unfit for the job. Now, was there... The fact of the matter is, though, is that there's some credence to it in that you have sons, daughters of powerful people in Washington getting these jobs that they probably otherwise wouldn't get. You know, whether it's Hunter Biden, John Kerry's son, those kinds of things. There are people that are getting jobs that probably shouldn't get them. But there's nothing illegal about that. And they're not working for their parents in this case. Hunter Biden didn't work in the government at all. He was a private citizen. And so just because you're a child of a senator or even a president doesn't necessarily mean that you have to just stop doing what you're doing. Now, the difference between that and other in the Trump kids is that they actually have jobs in the United States government. They have official clearances and things like that. So that would be a true conflict of interest because they'd be using their own position in the government. But if they were private citizens and they're going out and getting jobs because of their ties to the White House, is it illegal? Probably not. Is it unethical? Absolutely. And I think if you look at the things that happened with Hunter Biden, how he got the positions he was in, well, there probably is some unethical stuff, but definitely not illegal. And if anything, if one thing came out of this whole thing, I would hope that it would be that we can pass some legislation that would close that loophole. Unfortunately, I don't see that happening because the very people that are benefiting, or at least their families are benefiting from this kind of behavior, are the ones that would decide whether or not that they can actually do that. So it's going to take enough senators to be able to stand up and say, this isn't right. But do you think you're going to get get 218 in the House and 51 in the Senate to go along with that? Because if I'm Donald Trump and I get that kind of legislation in front of me, I'm signing it. Because that would be a big, big step for him. And he could make the argument then that, hey, the reason I'm doing this is because I'm trying to close these unethical loopholes. And yeah, you can argue all day long that Trump is by far the least, far from ethical. But it would make a political statement that I think would be an important political statement. I do want to end with this. Edward Snowden, the exiled former U.S. intelligence former CIA employee and contractor for the National Security Agency, he had access to some of the most sensitive information and closely held secrets. So another one that we didn't talk about today was Area 51. So here's what he had to say. He was interviewed by Joe Rogan on his podcast, and PSA for all the Area 51 stormers, chemtrail believers, and climate change deniers, Eric Snowden has researched the depths of the U.S. intelligence networks and can report that conspiracy theories are not true. So, and like any curious mind with access to the CIA's version of Google might do, he went in and searched for answers to some of society's most pressing questions. As it turns out, the U.S. government is not aware of any intelligent extraterrestrial life, he says. For the record, as far as I could tell, aliens have never contacted Earth, or at least they haven't contacted U.S. intelligence. Also, the moon landing did indeed occur. In case you're wondering, yes, man really did land on the moon. Climate change is real. Chemtrails are not a thing. He addressed the conspiracies on an episode of the Joe Rogan Experience podcast released, that would be Wednesday the 23rd. So October 23rd, if you want to go back and listen to the Joe Rogan Experience podcast on that day, saying there's no evidence of aliens and chemtrails and the like. He goes, I know, Joe, I know you wanted there to be aliens. I know Neil deGrasse Tyson badly wants there to be aliens, and there probably are, right? But the idea that we're hiding them, if we are hiding them, I had ridiculous access to the networks on the NSA, the CIA, the military, all these groups. I couldn't find anything. So it's if it's hidden, and it could be hidden, it's hidden really damn well, even from people who are on the inside. So, and the only thing that I still, you know, I'm not, the only thing with climate change that still bothers me, and I'll end with this, if there's any one conspiracy theory that I think has some merit to it, it's maybe the denying of climate change. Not the fact that the climate isn't changing, but of man-made climate change, or at least the fact that we can reverse it based on our population. I think a lot of it, if you're going to say that things are increasing, it has to do with the pure population of the Earth more than anything else, more than any other behavior that we could take to combat it. It's going to be the overpopulation of the Earth, I think, is going to be the biggest thing that could affect the climate more than cars and things like that. Because we've actually made a lot of changes in the way we consume, whether it's electricity, vehicles, things like that. We've reduced our carbon output, and yet it's still increasing. And that's just because there's just so many damn people on Earth. And there's countries that are just ignoring it. But I just, the one thing that always makes me wonder on climate change is, where does the actual, you know, where's the control piece of it? If you were to take the things that we're doing and in all the changes you're proposing to make, how do we know it would make that much of a difference? Because what's the control to show that it would? What's the control to say that, hey, this is just how the Earth changes over long periods of time? How do we control for the fact that before there were humans, before there were automobiles, before there was electricity and all that stuff, before even the Industrial Revolution, what was the climate like that back then? What was going into the atmosphere back then? And if we were to go back to that, would it reverse what we're seeing today? How do you know that? I guess I'd have to read more into the science to understand it. Maybe it's just a lack of understanding on my part. I'm not saying it's not true. It's just those are the questions I have in terms of climate change. And so that one's a theory that I know a lot of people that they think that this is a made up thing. And I can see the motivation to make it up, because there's a whole lot of money to be made from alternative energy and green stuff, you know, the Green New Deal and things like that. There's a lot of motivation, a lot of financial motivation to make that a hoax. And so, you know, it's kind of an anti-conspiracy theory, right? The conspiracy theory isn't that climate change is happening. It's denying that it's not happening is the conspiracy theory in this case. It's kind of the reverse of how it normally is. It's normally saying something, you know, the conspiracy theory is that something exists when it doesn't. Whereas in this case, the conspiracy theory is something that it doesn't exist when it actually does. So, all right, well, I know this has been a long episode. I know you've probably heard enough of me, so we're going to wrap up the show. Thank you for joining us on this special episode. We're going to be back to normal. We're going to have my dad back on next week. And it'll be my mom's birthday next week, so I'm looking forward to that. Remember to visit our website at themoderatepodcast.com. You can find all of our back episodes there. Visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/themoderatepodcast. And finally, you can find us on Twitter at themodpodcast1. Our bumper music is brought to you by Purple Planet. Visit purple-planet.com. to get your own royalty-free music. So until next time, my name is Jibby Davis, and we'll see you next week.